succeeded in explaining how I survived, much less completely recovered, from the full-scale bacterial onslaught that meningitis wrought on my brain cortex. Nor, for that matter, has anyone succeeded in explaining how on earth I contracted that meningitis to begin with. I have also become increasingly sure that there is a reason the arc of my experience had the shape that it did. My story followed a timeless pattern, one laid out with great concision in the Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem, "A man takes a journey to a strange and wonderful land. Returning, he wrestles with how such a journey could really have happened." Then, just at his point of total despair at how to make sense of it all, a piece of evidence appears, the final piece of the puzzle, the piece that makes him realize that all questions on the matter of whether it happened or not are over. It did happen, and as a result, the world is different. For me, that piece of evidence, that clue not to be argued with, occurred when I glanced at the picture of Betsy, the bird sister I'd never seen in life, and recognized her as the girl on the butterfly wing, the angelic being who had guided me on my journey through the beyond and back. That moment had a timeless, mythic quality to it. Truly, I believe it was supposed to. I don't want my story to become old for you. Not because I think I'm special, but because I am absolutely convinced that the story itself is. That's why, a year after the first edition of my book came out, I want to ask something of you. If my story spoke to you, if it made you feel, even for a moment, that what happened to me might really be true, don't let that feeling pass. Don't let my story become just another interesting story in a world already full of interesting stories. Don't let the implications of what happened to me drift over into the world of the familiar. Because what happened to me was real, and that realness has implications for you, whoever you are. A friend of mine, when I was trying to get across this sense of urgency I felt at keeping the newness of my experience alive, showed me a poem by the Spanish writer Juan Ramón Jiménez. "Are we standing now," the poem asked, "quietly, in the new life?" Those words captured my position in the first weeks after I came back, when all kinds of people were trying, with the best intentions, to bring me back around from my delusional notions of where I'd been and what I'd seen. I was standing, quietly, in a new life. Everyone was ready to welcome me back to the old world, the world I'd left behind before my experience. My fellow doctors were willing to explain to me how all that had happened was simply a garbled readout of my oxygen-deprived, bacteria-ravaged brain. I'd had a harrowing and highly unusual experience and a narrow, highly puzzling escape from what statistically should have been death or, at best, life as a vegetable. But beyond that, nothing had happened. Beyond that, there were still the cars in the street, still the bills in the mailbox, still the same old world I'd left behind. Wrong. We are truly living in a new world. Our view of the cosmos, of ourselves, of whom we are and where we are going, is changing swiftly and radically, and the new world that is emerging is strange, stunning, and positive beyond our wildest dreams. My story is part of this change. That is why, if you were moved by my book, my request to you is to take that feeling and work with it. Use what happened to me to change your own life and your own thinking for good. If you had faith before, use my story to keep that faith strong. If you are an unbeliever, use my story to kindle your curiosity about what is possible. Memory, Plato argued, is power. And it is memory that brings us out of the false definitions of ourselves that earthly life can lead us into. But we have to remember. To remember. Here are a few ways that I hope will help you to do just that. Number one, remember the limits of words and remember their power. In the very lengthy period of humans' time on earth when the written word did not yet exist, the wise were those who remembered the stories that defined the human situation. Stories that explained where humans came from, what kind of beings they really were, and where they went when they left the world at death. When the written word first came along, there was much concern that the power of the stories as they existed in living memory would be lost. With the sacred wisdom reduced to a series of scrawls, what would become of true memory? "The letter killeth," says 2 Corinthians, "but the Spirit giveth life." That's the paradox of words. They kill what they're supposed to communicate. God, love, peace, comfort, goodness. Not a single one of those words does what I want it to. Words, like any tool, can make you lazy. Specifically, they can allow you to forget. But they can also help you remember. With the healing of my cortex, language, earthly language, returned. Experiencing that return of language taught me, in a way I could never otherwise have learned or grasped, that as earthly creatures, we are beings of language. Words, both spoken and written, limit us, but they are also tools of marvelous power. Tools that, like our physical bodies, can feel cumbersome and frustrating. Both fail to do everything we want them to do. Both are burdens, but both are also great blessings. In heaven, no words are necessary. Meaning is conveyed directly. We speak using words here on earth because, as embodied beings, we have largely lost the ability for direct communication that we possess when beyond the body. Some, here on earth, can communicate in that more direct way, and experiments in telepathy suggest that all of us, at least at certain moments, can do so as well. But by and large, we are locked into a world of time and space and matter, a world where words must bridge a gulf that, in the regions of the universe beyond this one, doesn't exist. Both before and after the appearance of the written word on earth, all the sacred stories had one main goal: to help people remember who they really were. But it's not just sacred stories that can have this effect. I have a feeling that that's what my story, my particular collection of scrawls on a page, did. I deeply believe that there are few people who have read my book who haven't experienced at least some of what I experienced themselves. Part of the book's success is that the words within it have jogged a lot of memories. So in addition to my finding them frustrating, my gratitude to words is bottomless. Words are valuable beyond measure. Ignored, taken for granted, they become another earthly impediment. Taken seriously, they are tools for remembering who we are. Words are what we have down here. If the words of my story brought back a glimmer of your more than earthly memory, then I urge you to trust that feeling. In prayer, or meditation, or whatever feels right for you, go within and find that part of yourself that is always connected to the oneness of the core. I pray that the words I've given you, flawed as they may be, will help you every day to remember to remember. Number 2. Remember your brain's limits. The human brain is just slightly better equipped to comprehend the meta-picture of existence than that of a chimpanzee. A being with a brain 3 or 4 times as complex as ours would be capable of comprehending unfathomably more of the true universe than we can even imagine. If that being tried to describe the universe that it was experiencing to us, it would most likely sound the way the physics theory of double special relativity would to a chimp. That's not meant to denigrate chimpanzees, but it is meant to suggest how limiting our physical brains are and how far they are from giving us the complete picture of the true universe and our role in it. Evidence suggests that the human brain is now pushing its limits in terms of the amount of intelligence it is able to host. Earthly brain intelligence, in short, is limited by earthly rules. But the true selves we are, the selves who built our brains in collaboration with the physical universe, are not. We are in our brains now, but we haven't always been, nor, of course, will we be in the future, when the Spirit gives back to Earth the elements it had borrowed to form our temporary earthly bodies. The brain is a machine, an efficient and truly extraordinary one, but a machine all the same. When we forget this, even for a moment, we are in trouble. In a classic study reported by Benjamin Libet and others in the journal Brain in 1983, subjects were instructed to flex their wrists at random times as they observed a spot of light traveling in a circle on an oscilloscope. The oscilloscope orbited every 2.56 seconds, or 2,560 milliseconds, or MSEC. The subjects were to record the position of the spot when they first thought of making the spontaneous wrist movement. The awareness of initiating the movement occurred 200 milliseconds, plus or minus 20 milliseconds, prior to the actual movement. However, the electroencephalographic, or EEG, recording of a readiness potential that preceded each voluntary wrist movement occurred 350 milliseconds before the awareness of the impending movement. In short, this experiment showed that the brain initiated wrist movement almost a fifth of a second before the subject was aware of willing it. Our brains, in a very real sense, do much of our thinking for us. Some of that thinking, as in the case above, reaches our consciousness a fraction of a second after the thinking has actually occurred. But most of that thinking never makes it to our conscious mind at all. Right now, in fact, your brain is repressing from your conscious mind almost all the information flowing through it. This is, generally speaking, a very good thing. If we were conscious of all the activities the brain performs every moment of every day, we would soon go mad. But this is also bad, or at least problematic. For along with a whole lot of information that we don't need to know consciously, our brains are keeping from us some material that we would benefit very much from knowing. There is strong evidence that the brain is a quantum computer, that it receives information from the more than physical worlds and transmits information back to those worlds via means that science has yet to understand. We may be materialists, but our minds aren't. The physical brain simply can't afford to be out of contact with the superphysical world. But in the course of working to keep us alive on planet Earth, our brains can encourage us to think materialistically by blocking our knowledge not only of the spiritual world, but of our deep unity with it. Is this the brain's fault? Definitely not. Though it can be bossy and domineering as it works to keep us alive and in one piece here on the Earth, the brain does what it does for good reasons. The physical world is no picnic. It is hard to survive down here. The physical brain has evolved over hundreds of millions of years, packing as much useful, survival-oriented intelligence into itself as its 3 pounds of synaptic potential will allow. Every millisecond, it makes thousands of decisions about what we need to be conscious of and what we don't. In times past, and today too, one wrong decision about what does or doesn't make it to consciousness could mean injury to the bodily owner of that brain or death. The brain is the seat of our more than earthly minds while we are here on Earth. It is essential to our earthly sojourn. But it is also, during this sojourn, an instrument of suppression, blocking out our knowledge of the higher worlds. And one of the most problematic things it suppresses is our natural awareness of ecstasy and superabundance, an awareness that we were fully and gloriously in touch with when we were in the true universe before our physical birth. We are living constantly in superabundance. But that superabundance is selectively blocked from us because the brain, survival-oriented piece of equipment that it is, doesn't think we need to know about it. Ordinariness, drabness, everydayness, these are, in truth, stupendously hard illusions to achieve. To make the universe seem like a drab, dull, gray place for even a moment is one of the most astonishing feats that our brains perform. The most boring Sunday afternoon is a miracle past all imagination, but the brain doesn't want us to know this because it's afraid we'll get distracted from what it sees as the business at hand. Hence we miss much, all too much, of the wonder while we are here. The brain blocks us from the spiritual light, even as it makes it possible for us to function in the relative darkness of the physical world. During my coma, my cortex was essentially erased. As a result, that higher world, which I ordinarily kept repressed, flooded into my awareness with a clarity and brilliance that blew me away. That brilliance and clarity is the core reality of the universe. It's what really is. But we have allowed ourselves to be tricked by the survival-oriented parts of our brain to lose sight of that glory and that freshness that Wordsworth spoke of. Science is slowly unraveling the story of the brain's development, of how the demands of earthly life gradually molded it into the specific survival-oriented machine it is today. As it evolved, the brain grew more compartmentalized to meet the necessities of physical survival. Over the eons, those necessities led to the brain's sharp division into the left and right halves. This division plays a part in why we spend so much time cut off from the beauty and mystery that should be streaming into us every second, even down here on the relatively dense level of physical existence. For some time now, students of the brain have suspected that the pressures of life on Earth have gradually caused the left brain, which seems to control reason and categorization, to become overly censorious of the right side of the brain, which controls pattern recognition and creativity. There is evidence that this is true, to a degree. But what's important is to be conscious at all times of just how little of the true universe we are actually seeing at any given time. Through that knowledge itself, an opening appears, through which the larger universe has a chance to reach us and hopefully reorient us. For true progress on the Earth is only possible with this larger world in view. The sense of wonder should be a permanent possession of all adults, including scientists. Sadly, it isn't. Nowhere is this more clearly illustrated than in the history of that strangest of scientific discoveries, quantum mechanics. Even though quantum experiments have yielded increasingly astonishing facts about the universe, many physicists today seem to have become desensitized to these facts. The founders of quantum physics were so astonished by what they found that many turned into mystics. For the fathers of modern physics, understanding the implications of quantum phenomena was a kind of initiation. It showed these physicists that they were members of the universe. That membership, and the wonder that comes with it, is our birthright. Whoever we are, and however we make use of our brains to get by in the world, we should not let our brains prevent us from seeing the glory and miracle of where all of us are every second. Number 3. Remember, you are not alone. The universe we live in is one in which everything is connected. Not just in a manner of speaking, but actually. Every atom in your body and every subatomic particle of which those atoms are made is in profound and direct relationship with every other atom and particle in the universe. A universe that, like our bodies themselves, is composed not of hard, unyielding matter, but of energy. This energy, in turn, is made of something called consciousness. And consciousness itself is not made of anything, for it transcends all materiality. If we insist on envisioning consciousness as being made of anything, that substance must be the divine itself. We are, really and truly, connected to God at every moment. But most of the time, we are sadly unaware of this fact. On the level of our everyday consciousness, this is a world of separation, one where people and objects move about, occasionally interacting with each other, but with precious little connection beyond that. A world where, no matter how many people are around us, we are always alone. But this cold, dead world of separate objects is an illusion. It's not the world we actually live in. The world we really and truly live in is one of many more dimensions than the four we ordinarily perceive. It's one in which time moves backward as well as forward, where the mental, consciousness, soul, and spirit is more solid, more real, than the physical, and where the limitations that bind us during our time on Earth will fall away when, at death, we leave our physical bodies behind. This planet of ours is not by any stretch the only inhabited world in the physical universe. But the physical universe, with the life I am certain it contains, is only the very smallest portion of the life that the entire universe holds, for the vast majority of life exists on the spiritual, rather than the physical, plane. God, the God who can do anything and who cares for us more than he cares even for himself, is part of our very consciousness. As I discussed in Proof of Heaven, God has no gender. I use the male pronoun he to conform to convention. Despite the incomprehensible vastness of the worlds he commands, both visible and invisible, both physical and spiritual, he is right here in our very conscious existence, seeing what we see, suffering what we suffer, and loving us so much as to allow us the gift of free will, in spite of all of the suffering that might allow. The Hebrew word Emmanuel, God is with us, says it all. This was God's primary message to the Hebrew people, and Jesus' most important lesson is that he was born into this world to show us that God is within us all at every point in our journey. A journey that began with God, that ends with God, and that God is present with us for every glorious, beautiful, and sometimes truly agonizing step of the way. None of us is alone. This is precisely what I discovered in my own week-long NDE, when I was reunited with a member of my own family whom I had never known while on Earth. In that time beyond this world, I learned that we know the people who are dear to us down here far better than we think, and have known them for much, much longer than we think as well. And when the trials and terrors of this particular earthly life are done, we will look back together with our loved ones at the life we lived, this time around, in an atmosphere of total safety, knowledge, and love. If we could see ourselves like this every day, our whole perspective would be changed, because we'd be living sub specie aeternitatis, under the aspect of eternity. Number 4. Remember that faith leads toward, not away from, truth. We live in a time when different faith traditions simply have to begin to communicate more. But respecting other people's faiths does not mean watering down our own. And nowhere is this more the case than with the faith I was born into. Any pastor will tell you that the single concept that separates the wheat, that is, the real believers, from the chaff, those who are Christians in name only, is whether a person accepts that what Christian tradition says happened on Easter morning really happened. That Christ actually rose from the dead and walked, for a time, among the living before ascending into heaven. The entire force of the Christian message can be pushed into that moment when the rock rolled aside and Jesus, the same and yet not the same Jesus, whom his mother had watched die on the cross 2 days before, stepped out once more into common daylight. To be a Christian means to believe that Jesus overcame death, not just his own, but the larger death that was sown deep into the very fabric of existence. Now, I can tell you very plainly that if someone had asked me in the days before my NDE what I thought of this story, I would have said that it was a lovely, even a heroic one. But it remained just that, a story. Jesus was no doubt a great man, and the gospel of love and tolerance he preached was a noble one. But dead bodies don't return to life. To say that the physical body of a man who had been brutally tortured and killed could simply get up and return to the world a few days later is to contradict every fact we know about the universe. It wasn't simply an unscientific idea. It was a downright anti-scientific one. But I no longer believe it is. I can't, because my own NDE taught me otherwise. The exact nature of Christ's resurrected body has been a topic of deep and often bitter argument for centuries. I treat this question with the caution and respect it deserves, but that Jesus was capable of returning, and that this return carried with it the pure shock of the real to those who experienced it. This I accept in all its full and wonderful and world-changing implications. I believe. Not in a narrow, parochial sense, however. I believe in the spirit of the words of Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas, when he said, "I am the light that is over all things. I am all. From me all came forth, and to me all return. Split a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there." In short, I agree fully with the writers of the New Testament and certain of the Gnostic Gospels when they say that we are all potential beings of light, with a future glorious beyond all imagination. I believe that in resurrecting, Jesus did not break the physical laws of the universe so much as he revealed the true nature of the larger, far more miraculous universe we really live in. I believe that we are beings of light, and that the body we now inhabit has the same relationship to the spiritual bodies we will have as a seed bears to a plant, or a caterpillar bears to a butterfly. This, I believe, is the real meaning of the fact that when Jesus appeared to the apostles following his crucifixion in the Gospel of John, he was unrecognized by many who had known him and was able to walk through locked doors. This was a Jesus who was more than he had been, just as all of us will be when we leave our physical bodies behind. The Jesus of these episodes appeared again on earth, I believe, not to chastise or condemn, but to show that all of us are transphysical beings, and that our true home lies not in this earthly realm, but beyond it. I don't agree 100% with every one of the many different kinds of people of faith I meet, any more than I agree 100% with every one of the people I meet with no faith at all. But for me, that doesn't matter. My message is about unity, not separation, and it is my firm conviction that if it is mixed with love, no belief can separate. All faiths boil down to the ability to accept the miraculous nature of this universe we live in, the primacy of love, and the absolutely limitless power of its creator. As such, belief in any of them can move mountains. And the chief mountain that it can move is fear. The fear that is the deepest block to recovery of our true spiritual nature. Once you allow yourself to truly believe in a universe where love is actually stronger than the apparent rules of the physical world, fear begins to diminish. And as that seemingly immovable rock of fear moves to the side, the true world comes into view again. As many spiritual traditions agree, true love casts out all fear. Number 5. Remember that you have been here before. I get asked a lot of difficult questions when I give my talks. This is the most difficult. If the spiritual worlds are the worlds of true power and true meaning, and if God cares so much about us, why do all the tragic and unanswerable events that take place on earth every minute of every day have to happen? Why does God allow suffering, not just of people, but of all created beings? Needless to say, I can't answer this most difficult of all imaginable questions for everyone, but I can share the answer that I, for myself, have come to accept since returning from my experience beyond this world. But to do so, I need to bring in two concepts. The first of these concepts I believed in fully before my NDE. The second, on the other hand, I used to think was pure fantasy. These two ideas are evolution and reincarnation. Reincarnation, the belief that we live not once but many times in physical bodies, is embraced by many Eastern religions, and the more research that is done into the earliest years of Christianity, the clearer it is that the concept was very much alive among certain members of the early church as well. Most scholars agree that however many or few early Christians embraced reincarnation, just about all of them at least knew about it, for the idea was widespread in the Hellenic world the New Testament in part grew out of. Everyone knows that reincarnation continues to be a very lively idea today as well, not just in the East, but in what is often disparagingly called the New Age. But it is much more than an idea. It is a reality, one that we need to recognize if we are to make sense of the universe that science has revealed to us. That's where the equally hot topic of evolution comes in. The terrible and unnecessary arguments between belief on one side and science on the other that take up so much public discourse these days often focus on evolution as the enemy of faith. But evolution is, in fact, a hugely spiritual idea. With it, the universe reveals itself as in process. But we are in a much better position to see this deeply spiritual aspect of the doctrine of evolution if we open ourselves to the idea that, as we take part in this vast process, we are born more than just once. The still threatening and alien-sounding word karma can be a huge help in allowing us to understand this emerging vision of a multidimensional universe where evolving beings move back and forth from the world of matter to that of spirit as they travel ever forward. The word karma comes from a Sanskrit word meaning action, and is essentially the law of cause and effect applied on a physical and spiritual level. The law of karma assumes that the universe is more spiritual than it is physical, and that at the bottom it is not a jumble of separate parts, but a unity. It also assumes that consciousness, not matter, is the primary reality. In other words, it's a concept that both resonates with my personal spiritual experience and accords with the latest scientific research. In opening ourselves to the ancient Eastern idea of karma and reincarnation, of cause and effect at a more than simply physical level, we do not need to abandon or compromise the deep tenets of our faith, whichever particular faith that may be. For in accepting the ideas of karma and reincarnation, we also bring something to those ideas that the traditional, largely Eastern versions of them did not always possess, the concept of grace. One reason people in the West have been put off by traditional Eastern ideas about reincarnation is that these descriptions can have a cold, mechanical quality to them. Buddhism and Hinduism can both, at times, paint a picture of the universe as a vast, ever-turning wheel. On this wheel of existence, good actions yield good karma, bad actions reap bad karma, yet there seems to be no larger point to it all. Indeed, some Eastern texts have argued that the precise point is to realize the ultimate futility of incarnate existence, and thus to win freedom from the ever-turning wheel of life by entry into nirvana, a condition that means literally extinguishment, like that of a candle that has been blown out. Surely, many Westerners feel, even those actively open to Eastern ideas, something must be missing from this picture. And indeed there is. That something is the Western spiritual concept of grace. Make no mistake, I don't want to suggest that the grace concept is entirely missing from Eastern traditions. But I do believe that the Western faith traditions have something crucial to add to the Eastern faiths. An emphasis on the universe as the creation of a loving God who brought it into being for a purpose. You can probably guess where I'm leading with these arguments. It's a pretty simple point, actually. Wouldn't it be wonderful if, after all the arguments of East versus West, it turned out that the faiths of the East and those of the West actually complement each other? This is exactly the vision of the universe I see coming into being now. A vision woven of the deepest insights of the Eastern and Western traditions, and of science as well. A vision in which all actions have profound moral consequences, in which good and evil are not mere ideas, but profound realities. A universe in which no action, even the smallest, is without its moral consequence. This universe is, first and foremost, a place of growth. One where, as we move through the physical and spiritual worlds, we become ever more ourselves, ever more the individual, fathomlessly valuable beings that God intended, from the beginning, for us to be. The evolutionary timescale revealed by science is vast. Even vaster, of course, is the age of the universe that modern physics is sketching. And things become immeasurably vaster still, when we allow for the very high possibility that this universe itself is but one in a perhaps infinite series of them. God allows us the time and the space to find our way toward oneness with each other and with Him, a way that leads not back but ever forward, through births far past the single life we find ourselves in now. So yes, karma exists, but it is not the karma of a closed system, of some cold machine turning around and around forever. Karma is, instead, a part of growth, the growth of spiritual beings who suffer and change, who can learn from their mistakes, and who are on their way back to divine oneness with an unconditionally loving God. So when I bring up Eastern ideas like rebirth and karma in my talks, I am not talking about the simplistic idea that an innocent being suffering an unfairly short or painful life here on earth is paying for something done wrong in a previous life. That idea is as misguided as the equally pernicious one that when we go astray, we are punished for it by God. God, to begin with, does not punish. God is love. Of that I am certain. But when we encounter suffering in the world, either of people or animals, of ourselves or others, my feeling is that we need to refocus on the secret, divine identity of each being in the universe. We need to understand that as such beings, we are playing a part in a drama that is incalculably longer and more complex than we could ever understand within the few short years we spend in this earthly zone of blindness and uncertainty. This does not mean that we shouldn't do everything in our power to help our fellow beings when we can. It just means we should gain strength and cheer from the knowledge that everything happening here is part of a much, much larger story. This fact, that we are a seamless part of the larger universe and the story unfolding in that universe, is starting to emerge into true, full view for the first time, like a vast landscape emerging from the mists. All of us are starting to see more. The illusion of our aloneness, our powerlessness, and our separation is falling away. And both Eastern and Western faiths have a part in helping us understand that change. Number 6. Remember that we are going somewhere. Most of us have memories of taking car trips when we were kids. Trips that often started with a huge sense of anticipation, of going somewhere. That going somewhere sensation was often too big for the trip itself. We'd conjure up these feelings of journey and destination that the spots we got to, no matter how much fun we might have had there, couldn't completely live up to. That's because we were conflating that single journey with a much larger one. We are eternal. In the wake of my NDE, nothing could dissuade me of this fact, but we are not eternal in a static, frozen way, like a beautiful jewel sitting forgotten somewhere on a shelf. Each of us is constantly growing and changing. We have innumerable changes behind us and innumerable ones lying ahead. But beneath all those changes, the singular and eternal being that each of us is completely safe and completely secure. We are creatures of God, created by God, and loved by God forever. We are given the gift of free will to make our own choices. As we experience the illusion of separateness, we simultaneously long to be reunited with the divine oneness. We do this by growing and changing, struggling ever forward within a universe that is both material and spiritual, and that has been our home for far, far longer than we can imagine. In the new spiritual vision arising today, one does not have to be of a particular faith to understand that we are faced with two things. We long to return to oneness, but we also long to develop, to fulfill our potential as unique individual sparks of divinity, to become, through the joys and rigors and downright terrors of the world, beings who mirror, of our own free will, the deep love and compassion of the divine itself. We do this on our own steam, in our own way, and without His interference. A universe where free will is possible is a universe where suffering is possible as well, from the smallest, most everyday variety to the vast, universal falling away from God's love that is such a tragic part of human history. As a child of adoption who didn't know my own birth parents until I was well into adulthood, I know something of the pain that comes from longing for an absent parent and of wondering if that parent really loves or ever loved you at all. After finally meeting my own birth parents in 2007, I also learned how much the parents in such cases can themselves suffer. Not knowing if your child is alive or dead, happy or sad, or how much, though absent from their lives, you truly love them. As point 3 stressed, We are never truly separate from the divine, ever. But I know, both from my experiences in this world and beyond it, how much it can sometimes feel like we are. In journeying through the worlds of apparent separation, we often suffer greatly, but we are also learning to be ourselves, to each become the love-filled but unique and self-directing beings that we secretly long to become. We are not, no matter what materialist science may say to the contrary, moving in a simply random and pointless way, obeying laws of physical cause and effect, of survival of the fittest, that came into being arbitrarily. Instead, we and every other being in the universe are moving toward reunion with the divine, a reunion more fulfilling and glorious than any of us at our present level of development can even conceive. Number 7. Remember that we make our own reality. This, the oldest New Age cliche in the book, also happens to be true, but not in a simplistic way. Not in a wish for what you want and you'll get it way, but a much more profound and challenging one. It might be more accurate to say that we co-create our reality in collaboration with the divine. Quantum physics has shown that two interacting subatomic particles can share certain features, for example, paired spin or charge, and that measurements of one can influence the other instantaneously, no matter how far apart they are. This concept has been borne out repeatedly by ever more refined scientific experiments over the last few decades. Einstein referred to this effect as spooky action at a distance because it implied the instantaneous propagation of information around the universe in complete violation of Einstein's special theory of relativity. The essential non-locality of the universe that quantum entanglement demonstrates has very important implications for our individual consciousness. In 1955, John von Neumann, one of the great mathematicians of the quantum mechanics era, showed that the collapse of the wave function does not occur with the needle of the Geiger counter, or the photons from that needle striking the eye of the observer, or the firing of neurons along the optic nerve, or the neurons leading into association areas of visual cortex, or even into higher association areas where all sensory input is combined. His work suggested that the wave function collapse, in short, did not occur anywhere in the physical brain, but in the conscious mind of the observer. A conscious mind that cannot be located anywhere specifically in the brain, because it exists in a dimension beyond it. In short, everything is seamlessly and instantaneously connected to everything else. And what we think instantaneously has an effect on the world around us, an effect that is not metaphorical but actual, as real as a rock hitting a pane of glass. Quantum mechanics is the most proven field in the history of science. Cell phones, computers, global positioning systems, televisions, and countless other devices were created thanks to it. And quantum mechanics tells us that the conscious self, the real you and the real me, is so completely wired into the universe at large that this self actually determines reality. On a very real level, our consciousness makes the world happen. This is not to say that we can make a Mercedes appear in our driveway merely by wishing it so, but it does mean that our deep selves are completely entwined with the universe and collaborate with it in bringing our reality into being. What does this mean for us on a day-to-day level? Simply that we need to become more aware of the true role that our deep selves are playing in determining our reality. The universe has stupendous plans for us, but it is time for us to move out of the backseat, to stop letting our evolutionarily designed material brains determine the world that we see without our having any say in it. So many of us have gone through our lives thinking that matter is what's real, what's solid, and that consciousness is just a wispy little ghost. But in truth, consciousness is what comes first. It is what's real, and it is, in the final analysis, what counts. But understanding this on a theoretical level isn't enough. We have to experience it. We are the true protagonists, the true main characters, of the journey of the universe. but we are currently wrapped up in brain existence, and while this facilitates our functioning in the earthly realm, it also renders us hopelessly slow in intuitively understanding the nature of the true universe, which is dominated by the qualities of love, forgiveness, oneness, purpose, and meaning. Quantum mechanics deals with probabilities of occurrence based on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which states that nature prevents our knowledge of both the position and momentum of a subatomic particle simultaneously. It's almost as if we're not supposed to see beyond this. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle actually tells us that we can't ever entirely understand the world from our present consciousness, because doing so would necessitate giving up the core illusions of separation and distance that allow us to walk around and interact with each other each day. But we can understand more of it than we do now. At our deepest level, we are not separate from the universe. In fact, we are partners in its unfolding. But the brain that is doing the vast majority of the work involved in listening, invisibly and without your realizing it, has put us in the back seat and told us not to worry ourselves with what's going on up front. It's time for us to move to the front seat. It's time for us to grow up. It's time for us to remember. Number 8, 9, and 10. Remember, you are loved, you have nothing to fear, and you can do no wrong. How could I not end with these three points? They are, after all, the heart of my story, the core of my message, and I absolutely believe the reason what happened to me happened in the first place. But if we can, in an ultimate sense, do no wrong, that does not mean we can do no wrong down here on the physical plane. Nor does it mean that this world isn't a painful and terrifying place, or that evil of the most profound magnitude doesn't exist here. Instead, it means that in the true universe, the larger spiritual universe that we are in constant, if unconscious, contact with, we have nothing to fear. While on Earth, we are merely players on a stage, just as Shakespeare famously said we are. But when we die, we step off that stage, and when we do, we recover our full vision. We remember where we originally came from, what kind of a place the universe really is, and we catch a glimpse as well of where we're going. Though, of course, we can't see it all. All of us are dancing around the real secret of the universe, just as Robert Frost suggested in his poem, The Secret Sits. But the secret itself remains ungraspable. Every second of every day, your deep self is completely connected, or entangled, to use the language of physics, with the true universe. That is the secret, and it sits every second, every nanosecond, at the center of each of our existences. We do not stop at death. But on Earth, we are equipped with brains that, designed by ourselves in collaboration with the universe and the Creator, all but completely cut off our knowledge of that fact. We walk about not knowing that we are eternal beings in an incalculably long process of growth toward becoming who we were always truly meant to be. Like a salmon swimming upstream to the place where it was hatched, struggling and fighting hard against the current at times, we know all along, on a deep level, where we came from. Every moment of mystery you have ever experienced is a hint and a glimpse of that self we are so largely unaware of. It's the self I chased after as a young man by diving out of planes, and the self I still chase after when I ski a New England double black diamond slope with Eben the Fourth, or ride a roller coaster with Bond. All of us know this self, and all of us alternately chase after it and deny it, see it, and then lose sight of it. We recognize it in others, especially those we love deepest. We see it most clearly in them, and in those moments when we do see it, the idea of denying it is completely preposterous. It is intelligent past imagining, but getting in touch with it is not a matter of intellect. Because in the last analysis, it is who we are. We know more about the entire rest of the universe than we know about this being. And yet we need to learn nothing, because it is already us. The place we are going is one where the terrors and confusions of this life will be resolved. But that resolution does not mean that evil and what Christianity traditionally calls sin do not exist. Of course they do, but they are not able to touch or triumph over the goodness and love that are the heart and soul of the true universe. Most of the pain we experience in the world comes from one source, lack of faith that love is real. That's not to deny physical pain and hardship. No doctor could ever do that. But when we lose the sense of the concrete physicality of love, that love is entirely more real than anything in our life, then the lower part of life conquers us. You are loved. That was the most important message of my journey. I needed that message at the time of my experience because of my core wound from adoption, of unworthiness, guilt, and abandonment. The universal truth of unconditional love from the source is the most powerful message of my odyssey. It starts with loving yourself, which empowers you and connects you to oneness. This can be done through personal spirituality regardless of one's religion. It exists in each one of us. The mystical traditions of all great faiths offer the same non-exclusive message. It is all about connecting to the divine through the heart. I learned through my NDE and the growth it engendered to love myself. This, then, allows me to love others more fully and to feel a connection to all and everything, including nature, animals, and all beings. When you love yourself, you become love. And this connects you to the divine. Remind yourself every day that the power of love, personal love, is stronger than every tumor, every accident, every act of evil, every single brutal and terrible or just mundane small bad thing that happens to us on earth. Does this solve the world's problems? No. But it is the key to beginning to solve every last one of them. Knowing our true identity as divine and immortal beings, seamlessly united to all other beings and to our loving Creator, not as some nice fluffy sentiment, but as rock-hard truth, solid and sure, is the key to making everything in our life better. All is well. We are living in a new world.
Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Seeking Heaven, Sound Journeys into the Beyond, an original audio guide to attaining expanded consciousness by Eben Alexander, M.D. with Karen Newell. Read by the authors with Sound Journeys by Sacred Acoustics. In Proof of Heaven, Dr. Eben Alexander tells us that working with guided audio programs has helped him achieve the deeper level of consciousness needed to glimpse anew the idyllic realm he describes in the book, and suggests that all of us can use similar audio programs to expand our consciousness for comparable results. In Seeking Heaven, Dr. Alexander presents 4 30-minute audio journeys produced specifically to support and enhance the experience of those who want to access the state of blissful higher consciousness and self-knowledge that he attained during his near-death experience. Developed and presented with audio meditation specialist Karen Newell, co-founder of Sacred Acoustics, these 4 sound journeys combine digital harmonic frequencies, sacred instruments, sounds from nature, and the human voice to help listeners recreate the 4 stages of Dr. Alexander's miraculous spiritual experience. Everything is a vibration, thinning the veil, shift your perspective, and connecting with Source. These journeys to the spiritual core of existence are designed to help you separate yourself from day-to-day concerns and find out about your true self, appreciate the nature of our interconnectedness, and access a transcendent understanding of hope, comfort, forgiveness, and love. With Seeking Heaven, Dr. Alexander helps you get in touch with the profound wisdom imparted in the spiritual realms he visited and experience it in your own life. Seeking Heaven is available on CD and digital audio download wherever audiobooks are sold.
Appendix A, Statement by Scott Wade, M.D.
As an infectious diseases specialist, I was asked to see Dr. Eben Alexander when he presented to the hospital on November 10, 2008, and was found to have bacterial meningitis. Dr. Alexander had become ill quickly with flu-like symptoms, back pain, and a headache. He was promptly transported to the emergency room, where he had a CT scan of his head and then a lumbar puncture with spinal fluid, suggesting a gram-negative meningitis. He was immediately begun on intravenous antibiotics targeting that and placed on a ventilator machine because of his critical condition and coma. Within 24 hours, the gram-negative bacteria in the spinal fluid was confirmed as E. coli. An infection more common in infants, E. coli meningitis is very rare in adults, less than 1 in 10 million annual incidents in the United States, especially in the absence of any head trauma, neurosurgery, or other medical conditions, such as diabetes. Dr. Alexander was very healthy at the time of his diagnosis, and no underlying cause for his meningitis could be identified. The mortality rate for gram-negative meningitis in children and adults ranges from 40 to 80%. Dr. Alexander presented to the hospital with seizures and a markedly altered mental status, both of which are risk factors for neurological complications or death, mortality over 90%. Despite prompt and aggressive antibiotic treatment for his E. coli meningitis, as well as continued care in the medical intensive care unit, he remained in a coma for 6 days, and hope for a quick recovery faded, mortality over 97%. Then, on the 7th day, the miraculous happened. He opened his eyes, became alert, and was quickly weaned from the ventilator. The fact that he went on to have a full recovery from this illness after being in a coma for nearly a week is truly remarkable. Scott Wade, M.D.
Appendix B, Neuroscientific Hypotheses I Considered to Explain My Experience. In reviewing my recollections with several other neurosurgeons and scientists, I entertained several hypotheses that might explain my memories. Cutting right to the chase, they all failed to explain the rich, robust, intricate interactivity of the gateway and core experiences, the ultra-reality. These included 1. A primitive brainstem program to ease terminal pain and suffering. The evolutionary argument. Possibly as a remnant of feigned death strategies from lower mammals? This did not explain the robust, richly interactive nature of the recollections. 2. The distorted recall of memories from deeper parts of the limbic system, for example, the lateral amygdala, that have enough overlying brain to be relatively protected from the meningitic inflammation, which occurs mainly at the brain's surface. This did not explain the robust, richly interactive nature of the recollections. 3. Endogenous glutamate blockade with excitotoxicity, mimicking the hallucinatory anesthetic ketamine, occasionally used to explain NDEs in general. I occasionally saw the effects of ketamine used as an anesthetic during the earlier part of my neurosurgical career at Harvard Medical School. The hallucinatory state it induced was most chaotic and unpleasant, and bore no resemblance whatsoever to my experience in coma. 4. N,N-dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, dump, from the pineal or elsewhere in the brain. DMT, a naturally occurring serotonin agonist, specifically at the 5-HT1A, 5-HT2A, and 5-HT2C receptors, causes vivid hallucinations and a dreamlike state. I am personally familiar with drug experiences related to serotonin agonists and antagonists, that is, LSD, mescaline, from my teen years in the early 1970s. I have had no personal experience with DMT but have seen patients under its influence. The rich ultra-reality would still require fairly intact auditory and visual neocortex as target regions in which to generate such a rich audiovisual experience as I had in coma. Prolonged coma due to bacterial